Now, that's the hardest thing I've had to do all morning. The rest of it's going to be a breeze. Hi, everybody. My name is Hank Johnson, and I'm an alcoholic. And before I forget, I want to thank Al and his committee for substituting me in for Wayne, whoever he is, and wherever he is. I do know Wayne. I used to drink. I thought I better throw that in right now because I know I don't look like a drinker. And I went into a bar when I was 18 years old. I got all dressed up in a suit of clothes. I went into a bar. I ordered a drink. The guy served me, and immediately I became a man. Because a man can order a drink over a bar without being asked how old he is. And from that moment on, I was grown up. And actually what happened is the guy served me the drink, and I maintained an 18-year-old set of emotions for the next 30 years. You know, it says in the 12 and 12, I think, you know, that the doctors took a survey of what alcoholics all have in common, because they're all colors and sizes and nationalities and everything, just what do we have in common? And after careful study, they found out that we're grandiose and immature. And that kind of takes care of me, you know. And anyway, the guy served me, and I liked the atmosphere of that bar. I could play the jukebox over in the corner just as good as the rest of the guys. In fact, I thought my selection of songs were a little better than most. And I sat there at the bar and looked at myself and got better looking after each drink, and I just went back every opportunity I had from then on. From then on, I drank. From then on, I was under the influence of alcohol for the next 30 years. I don't mean I was drunk all the time, but I was under the influence. I thought about it all the time, and the people I hung out with, and it all had to do with drinking. And I met my wife in a bar. Where else do you meet girls? You know? And but she was a very strange person, because she was sitting there drinking a Coca-Cola, and I should have been suspicious, but I wasn't. I married that girl, and that's when the trouble began, and because she didn't drink, and she didn't like the way I drank. And we had a turbulent marriage, I'll put it that way. And she, she wasn't under the influence of liquor. She was under the influence of her mother. And she checked everything out with her first. And the dreaded Roseanne. That's what my kids used to call her. And so, you know, we separated a lot. She'd kick me out. I'd move down the street, and then I'd move back in about a month, and in and out, back and forth. She divorced me 3 times. And the last time she divorced me, I says, you know, you want a divorce? Well, you can have it. This time, I'm not playing this silly game with you anymore. You can have the house, you can have the furniture, you can have everything. All I want is my stack of old 78 records. And they're collector items, and I want them. And she was glad to get rid of them and me. And I moved to a little garage house, a little garage I had made some living quarters in Hermosa Beach, California. And the landlady said, you know, we're only a half a block from the sand, you know, just water just right down there. I thought, man, that is terrific. I'm going to get up every morning and run at 6 o'clock. I'm going to run 5 miles along the ocean edge. When I get through running, and I'm going to plunge into the water, and I'll body surf a few waves in. And God, I just feel so good, you know. As far as I know, the water was down there. I never really got around to checking it out for sure. I was going to. I only lived there 4 years. I was getting ready to. And a typical day back then was that I would oversleep, and I'd wake up with a start, and it'd be 10 o'clock or more, and I was supposed to be at the office by 9, and geez, I'd throw my clothes on and get in that car and weave in and out of traffic. I had to get there. You see, I should have worked yesterday. And I'd left all these papers in my desk drawer. Some of them were months old. They were too old to turn in. If I turned them in, I'd be fired. If I didn't turn them in, I'd be fired. And, you know, and that's when I first, you know, when I came to AA, I heard this thing, and feeling of impending doom. And that was it. That was the feeling I had driving to work. And I knew by the time I got there, there'd be a note on my desk, see the boss, and I was finished. Because I had drank my wife away, my kids away, and home away, and all I had left was my job. And I worked for a pretty big company, and they put my name on business card, and that's who I was. If they fired me, you know, I'd just be a big zero. And And I'd get to work, and I'd check. First thing I'd do is check my desk out. Everything appeared to be the same as yesterday. And I'd go to the coffee shop or coffee room and get a cup of coffee, and come back to my desk and shuffle papers and make excuses and try to look interesting. And I could hardly wait till a respectable time to go to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. I'd check it out, and about 10:30, or 11:30 maybe, I'd go over there. And they served martinis over there. And I like martinis. And they served double martinis during the lunch hour for a dollar. The regular martinis were 75 cents. And so, whoever heard of having one martini? You're going to have two anyhow. So you might as well order the dollar one. You'll save 50 cents. God knows you need the money back. So I'd get to sipping on my dollar martini and kind of put my drink close to the guy sitting next to me. He'd have a 75 center. And I'd say to myself, who in the hell do they think they're getting? This isn't a double. It's a little larger than the 75 center, that's all. If it were really, if it was really a double, they'd be charging more money for it. Who do they think they're kidding? You know, so I better have another one. And then I'd have another one. And then I'd call the office and tell them, I forgot to tell you, I'm going on a lot of calls this afternoon. Take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd head towards the beach. And I'd stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka you could find. There's a liquor store on every corner in Southern California, and I knew just where to buy the cheap vodka. And I'd get home about 1:30, 2 o'clock. And I'd hang up my suit carefully so the creases fall properly, and put my shirt away and all that stuff, and put my pajamas on. And it would be 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'd sit on the edge of that bed, and I'd say to myself, well, you've done it again today. This cannot continue. You know, you're not the only guy that's been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why don't you do something about it? All you do is sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any action on anything. You know, then I'd untap that cheap vodka and take a big, big jolt out of it, several swallows. And I'd put an old 78 on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, "Who Can I Turn To?" And then I'd go into my fantasy. You know, I used to have these wonderful ideas how to, you know, why don't you, and then I'd talk to myself, why don't you get a second job? You know, hell, I wasn't even working for it. Get a second job and you'll earn a little more money and get your bills paid, you know. And then I'd say to myself, well, you don't need a second job, you know, you're in sales. If you're in sales, you can make as much money as you want, you know, within reason, of course. And by God, that's right. Starting tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. I'm going to get down to that damn office by 7. I'm going to knock out paperwork for a couple hours. When that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready to do business. And starting tomorrow, a whole new life is going to open up. And I'm going to even quit. I'll quit drinking. Yeah. Jesus, what a terrific idea. Sometimes I just amaze myself, you know, the solutions I could come up with. I'm not only a procrastinator, I also kind of think in the future, you know, project. And I think, you know, if you can do this for a year, you could be out of debt. By God, that's right. So I'll put a big red X on the calendar. And starting tomorrow, I'm going to work 365 days in a row. You know, I'm not bound by any time schedule. I can work whatever hours I want to. You know? And starting tomorrow, man, every waking moment, I'm going to be earning money. And at the end of 365 days, you know, and I'll have a new car paid for. All those bills will be paid. In fact, I think I'll buy her a car too. I'll buy her a white Lincoln Continental, and I'll drive it up to that house where she still lives, and I'll buy a card from the Hallmark card shop. You know, no cheap card, expensive card with all the beautiful poetry on it. You know, that sticky, sentimental poetry. Then I'll put right on the back, on the left side, "Thanks for all the good years, H." Not Hank or Henry, just H. And I don't know if she got it. No, that's class, you know. And I'll drive that car up there like at midnight. I'll drive down and make a U-turn in the cul-de-sac, and I'll coast up in front of the house. And I'll have a gold-plated key to that car, too. And I'll put it in the envelope with the card, and I'll tiptoe up on the steps, and I'll put that card down the mail chute. And then I'd split. Next morning, she'll get up. She'll go through her routine. And she'll see all those letters. Then she'll see that one that's no address on it or anything, no stamp. And so she'll open up that one first. And she'll open it up. A key will fall out. And she'll wonder what the key is. And she'll read that card, that sticky, sentimental poetry. Tears will just roll down her cheek. You know, it'll really affect her. And then she'll get to looking at that key, wondering what the key is for. And then somehow she'll look out in front of the house, see that white Lincoln Continental out there, brand new, you know. And she'll put it all together that that's her automobile. Then she'll be sorry, by God. I don't know about you guys, but I love to give them those expensive gifts. Then I just get on with my drinking and fantasizing and stuff, and I'd look up at the clock and it'd be 10:45. You know, my God, where is this day gone? I can't believe it's 10:45. Then I'd realize the liquor store closed at 11. So I'd throw my clothes on over my pajamas and run 2 blocks to the liquor store. I had to get there before 11, the place closed down, and I'd get there just in time. That's when I first started jogging, about that time. And I'd go in and give me a bottle of Smirnoff's. I always bought the better brands there in that local liquor store. I wouldn't want anybody to think I was cheap right there in the neighborhood, you know. And I could stroll back to my shack with peace and contentment and security for the rest of the night. And I'd play some upbeat music now, because I've had the solution to my problems, and things were looking good. And then I'd start rehearsing the speech I was going to have to give, because I knew I was going to be salesman of the year. And somewhere in there, I'd pass out. That's one advantage I had over most drunks, is I didn't get in any trouble drinking. It's pretty hard to get in trouble sitting on the edge of your bed in your pajamas, you know, drinking, you know, and all you got to do is just fall back. You're okay. You know. Anyhow, I'd pass out, and I'd wake up the next morning with a start, and it'd be 10 o'clock. I'm already an hour late to work. Oh, man, I get in that car, weave in, and I had to get there. I should have worked yesterday. Today's the day I'm going to be fired. I know it. And I'd get there and check everything out. Everything appeared to be the same. I'd go to the coffee room, get a cup of coffee, come back to my desk and try to look interested and answer. People would call and they want to know where their stuff was. And you didn't get that in the mail? Well, I'll look into this right away. And the class of help we have to hire sometimes, they just don't know what the word service means. And I'll get to the bottom of this. Now, the bottom is in the bottom of my desk drawer is where it was. And so I'm one of the originators of the computer excuse. We've all heard it. You know. The computer's been down for the last 4 days. As soon as we get it fixed, I'll get a printout and I'll call you. I'm one of the originators of that excuse. I used that excuse before we even had a computer in our house. And I'd sit there for till about 11:30, and I'd go next door to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked, and make my big decision of the day, whether to have the dollar one or the 75-center. And then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one. Then I'd call the office and tell them, I forgot to tell you. Going a lot of calls, take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. I'd go home and change into my pajamas and sit on the edge of the bed and untap a bottle of cheap vodka that I bought. And I didn't do that once or twice. I did that hundreds of times. Sometimes towards the end of the month, the boss would want to know, are you in sales here? And I'd say, yeah, I'm in sales. Well, how about selling something? And I'd say, don't worry about a thing. I'm a fast finisher. And I was, because money really, you know, I want the money too, but fear motivated me. You know, you scare me enough, and I'll work, man. And I would work around the clock then. And I always made my quota every year. And if you make your quota or exceed it, then they give you a big plaque with your name on it. And Hank Johnson, wonderful product knowledge and all that stuff, all of that plaque. You know. And I won a plaque every year for 8 drunken years in a row. I won a plaque. And I can't tell you how I did that, because when I got sober, I didn't win a plaque for 8 years. I was sure if I quit drinking that I was going to make a lot of money. That was all that was holding me back. You know? And it just isn't so. And that disappoints a lot of people, a lot of guys that I've sponsored. You know? Jeez, I thought I could really make a killing now that I'm sober. You know? But I couldn't even work. And I got involved with the Pacific Group in Los Angeles, and Clancy became my sponsor, and he had a lot of assignments for me that I didn't appreciate, you know. He said, you know, all these years you've been winning plaques, your fellow salespeople, they were doing your work for you. You know, people would come in with a complaint and they'd take care of it for you. And he says, so what I want you to do, he says, I want you to go to work at 9 o'clock in the morning and stay till at least 5 o'clock. And I says, Jesus, you know, I'm an outside salesman. You know, I'll starve to death, but if you tell me, I'll do it. And I did. And it's funny, I made more money that year than I did the previous years, because, you know, I don't know, I was there. I was available to my customers. And then the newness of being sober kind of wore off, and I just wasn't doing work properly, and I was slipping back into my old ways, and I walked into the office one time after about 2 years of sobriety, and there was a note on the desk, see the boss, and I went into his office, and he fired me after 2 years of sobriety. I says, what do you mean you're firing me? I said, I got an outstanding sales record with this company. He said, not lately, you don't. And I says, well, you know, I'm going to go over your head, because I just don't think, you know, you ought to fire me. And I went to the regional manager and went to see him, and I says, you know, you know what they've done? They fired me down there at the branch office. Can you believe that? Me, with my outstanding sales record. And he just shook his head, I says, what they don't know is that about 2 years ago, I completely changed my life, trying to make it with my wife and children, and I trying to pay my bills and become a citizen in the community and all this stuff. He said, Hank, I'm really sorry they fired you, but I can't tell them that they've got to keep you there. I can't do that. He says, but what I can do is put you on paid leave of absence. You say you're a salesman. Go sell yourself to another branch office. We got 80 of them. And that's what I did. And things, you know, about that time, Clancy got a hold of me, and he says, you know, I got so spiritual during that 2 years, I didn't even think I had to work. You know, I don't know who I thought was going to do my paperwork for me, but I just kind of sailed into the office and spent the day calling other members of Alcoholics Anonymous and giving advice to people and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I really deserved to be fired, because I was using the company phone to make, you know. Anyhow, he says, you claim to be a salesman. Go sell yourself to another office. And he says, I sure hope you and your wife make it and you get all straightened out, Hank. And so I did transfer, and things did get better. and eventually I won a plaque again. And I got a little nervous about winning the plaque. You know? I didn't want it to become a habit, you know. And so that's the way it was. Well, you know, my son turned 16 years old, and he was working on the pier there in Redondo Beach and washing dishes and stuff in the evenings. And he went to a Christmas party, and he got drunk. And they took him home, and they rang the doorbell, and my then ex-wife went and got him out of the car, pulled him out of the car, and she called me a few minutes later and said, "Come and get your drunken son. He's just like you are." And you know what I should have said was, "Wait a minute. You know, we had a divorce. Went to court. And you won him in the settlement. You're having problems with him? Well, deal with it. You know, that's what I should have said. But what I said, okay." And I went and got him. And I brought him back to my little shack there by the beach. He loved that place. And he was a surfer. And so we moved in together. And that was the start of a beautiful relationship that we've got going to this day, because we built our friendship on a common thing. You know, Mom had kicked us both out. We had that to build from, and we did. We did well. And my ex came down one Sunday to check him out, and we got to talking. And you know how that is. You saw one thing led to another. And what we ought to really do is sell that house and use the money, equity money, to pay off our bills and get a fresh start. And we talked all afternoon, and promising things to one another all afternoon. And so she moved in too. You know, what she said, I won't fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, I'll join you. And I should have been suspicious, but I wasn't. But during that 2 or 3 years we were apart, she had started drinking, and she became an alcoholic immediately. You know, I think I became an alcoholic when I bought that drink over a bar. But you know, I was lucky. I enjoyed my drinking. And I had a lot of fun with drinking for a lot of years. And before I start getting in a little trouble with it. But, you know, some drinkers, the first time they get drunk, it's a riot happens, you know. They have automobile accidents, they get in fights, they're thrown in jail, they don't, you know. And that's the kind of a drinker she was. And, you know, she'd take one drink, and she'd black out, and she just, her personality just changed completely. And she was a very nice person, and people liked her and everything when she wasn't drinking. But geez, when she drank, she had bad news. And it's just the opposite with me. If I'm not drinking, I'm kind of a grouchy guy. I'm not all that happy about situation, and I just sit around and gripe and everything. But you give me one drink, and you know, I don't care who you are, you're the most interesting person I've ever met in my life. I want to talk with you. I want to hear your life story, and I'm prepared to sit up all night with you and hear your plans for the future, as long as we got booze. And that's kind of a drinker I am. And we would reverse personalities when we drank. And so I'd listen to these old records and I called one night. I remember especially, I woke her up and said, "You've got to come in the living room here. You've got to hear this song." And she was waking up out of a deep sleep, you know, and brought her in and sat her down on the couch, in the middle of the couch, so she could hear the Stereophonics coming, you know. And they were all 78. And I sat her, positioned her, and I put this record on. And isn't that a terrific record, you know? And she'd look at me, you know, what a, you know? And she'd walk over to the phonograph, pick up the record, and don't break that record. It's a collector's item. Bang! I'll never have to hear that thing again, you know? And that's the way we lived. And I continued, you know, drinking at my lunch and coming home and changing into my pajamas and all that. And my son would come home from school. It'd be about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 2:30, something like that. And I'd ask, you know, I said, school don't even get out till 3. You're already home here at 2:30. You know, you've ditched class. You know, maybe all day for all I know. And I'd stand there in my pajamas and I with a bottle of vodka in my hand. And I would ask him, you know, how the hell do you ever expect to amount to anything? You know, if you don't apply yourself in this world, you haven't got a chance. And he'd look at me funny, and he always had 3 or 4 guys with him, and they all looked at me funny. And they went out surfing or whatever they're going to do, you know. And that's kind of the way our life was, you know. And one night my wife decided we had this real bad argument, and I said, I'm going to go to my brother's house tonight and stay overnight with him. And my son had gone somewhere to stay overnight, and I said, you know, I allowed you to kick me out of all those other places, but I moved here first. We're not getting along. This is worse than it's ever been, you know. And so I'm going to my brother's house tonight, and while I'm gone, I expect you to pack and leave. It's more time than you ever gave me. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. So while I was gone, she decided to commit suicide. And that's what she was kind of a, you know, she tried to commit suicide a lot, and she always failed. She got into AA, and she was suicidal. And she finally got a sponsor. And her sponsor said, you know, you better stop that crap. One of these days, you're going to hurt yourself real bad. And so she did. One particular day, I don't know what it was wrong, after she got in AA, you know, she had a particularly bad day. She said, when I get home tonight, I'm gonna commit suicide. This was after she was sober for a while. And so she got home, and then she remembered she was the cookie lady at the meeting that night, and so she had to postpone it. So, you know, sometimes you wonder why they give some of these jobs to some of these flaky people. The reason they give the jobs to them is because they need it to stay sober. And I'm one of those guys. So anyhow, she decided to commit suicide. But before she did, she went into the closet where my clothes were hanging and just took a knife and slashed every stitch of clothes I owned, just ripped everything, cut my ties in half and cut the pant legs off my pants and ripped the coats and, you know, shirts just ruined everything. You know, even stabbed my damn shoes. You know. I got home the next morning, and I went to my brother's house and drank with him, I came home the next morning. And she had gone, then she'd gone into the living room, broke the lamps and all my records, and, and just made it complete. You know, it looked like a bomb went off in there. And she turned the gas on the kitchen oven and went to bed. And the next morning, she woke up, you know. And that old place we lived in, you know, was just a half a block from the beach there, and the wind used to whistle through those boards of that old house, and you could have turned the gas on 10 ovens and never even smelled it. So, you know, but she woke up and she looked around and she couldn't believe what the condition of that house, and she knew that both of us were gone, and she didn't remember doing it, but she knew she had done it. And I came home about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I looked around. Oh, God, and Matt, our son, came home a little later and looked around. He thought we were moving again. We used to move a lot, and so that's the way it was with us, and only a lot worse, and. And that's when we hit bottom, you know. When we got married, we were going to live a good life. You know, we had plans what we were going to do and everything. And we were going to live the good life. But all we had managed to do over a period of years is sit around and drink every bit of goodness out of our lives. And from then on, nothing was good. And so I didn't quit drinking, you know. I hit several bottoms, you know, but I just drank through every one of them. And but I wasn't having any good feelings about my drinking and all. And we just hit bottom. And we went back to this doctor that was recommended by my, you know, we went to therapy for about 15 years off and on, and about the only thing I ever learned in therapy is that my mother-in-law had grave emotional problems, and if she'd just stay away, maybe we'd be all right, you know. And why didn't she get a life, for God's sake? Well, she'd come to dinner, you know, she was like the man that came to dinner. She'd come to dinner and stay several days, and so. And so anyhow, this therapist told me to go to this doctor, and he advised me to come to AA, and because his wife was an alcoholic, and she had gone to AA, and she was sober 7 months, and she was doing great, and all that stuff. And so she went back to that doctor. She had been with me and heard all that stuff. And she said, "Do you think I'm an alcoholic?" And he said, "I don't know, but why don't you go to a meeting with my wife? She'd be happy to take you." And so she went to AA. And to be a good guy, I would go to AA once in a while. And I hated it. You know, a bunch of squares, I thought. Yeah. And So people, you know, I just stayed for about a year. I didn't join AA. People were trying to, "Are you an alcoholic?" "No, I'm not an alcoholic." "She's one. Work on her." And "I'm a visitor." But finally I told her, you know, I am going to quit drinking. I've got the message. I heard Clancy talk. I thought he was great. And we'd go hear Clancy sometimes on Friday nights. We'd find out where he was speaking. And we'd drive to Cucamonga or someplace and hear him speak. And then we'd argue about what he really meant. And all that kind of stuff, you know. He's not the same. He left that part out from last week. But we got into. So I told her. I said, "I guess I am an alcoholic, but I'm not going to go to AA. I'm just quitting." And I did. And I quit a little bit before Thanksgiving. And I didn't drink through the drinkingest part of the year, the holiday season. in a day after Christmas, I got to thinking about the situation. And I hadn't drank for about 40 days. And so I said, you know, I proved that I'm not really an alcoholic. So I went to the liquor store and I bought a half a pint of vodka and I drank it straight down practically. And what the hell did I buy a half pint for? Went and got a fifth, got another fifth, and I drank all Saturday night and all day Sunday. And I woke up, it was like 10 o'clock on Monday morning, and this terrible hangover, but I went to work, because you always go to work on the Monday after a holiday. Always. If you don't show up, then they know. They know that you've got a drinking problem. So I went there, and I was sick. I was really sick. And because I poured all that alcohol into my system all at once after about 40 days. And so I went to the bar a little early that day. And I ordered a Bloody Mary, because that's what you order when you're sick. It's not a social drink of any kind. It's just medicine. And he got this big tall glass and he put a shot of vodka and tomato juice and Tabasco and Worcestershire sauce and topped it off with hot sauce and all that stuff, salt, and he stirred it. I thought he'd never get the damn thing made, you know. And he finally got it made and he gave it to me. I drank it straight down. Whew, man. And I looked down and I'd spilled half of it all over my tie. So I went to the restroom and cleaned the tomato juice off my tie. And by the time I got back, because I told him when I finished that Bloody Mary, I said, make me another one. And then I went to the restroom and and when I came back, he said, did you want another Bloody Mary or did you want a martini? And I said, I'd just skip it. I went over to the coffee shop section of that bar and I had a sandwich and a glass of milk and I haven't had a drink since. And that was December the 29th, 1969. And I'm very, very grateful that something happened there. You know, whenever I listen to people like Clancy's talk last night, you know, why didn't he drink again? You know, what? It just, that was his last day. I don't know. It's kind of a mysterious thing sometimes, people. And that's the way I feel with me. I had no intention of that being my last drink. In fact, I've thought about it afterwards. Geez, Bloody Mary is being my last drink. I'm really ashamed, you know. And, you know, that's a lousy drink to end up on, you know. What I should have done is I should have said, you know that dusty bottle back there, that 50-year-old brandy, 50-year-old brandy you got there, pour me some of that in one of those nice glasses, and you know, and I could have swirled it around and appreciated the aroma of it and all that, and then drank it and smashed the glass and stomped out of the bar, triumphant over alcohol, but. That's not the way it happened. And I got Clancy as a sponsor, and he had me playing baseball. I was 48 years old. And hell, I stopped playing baseball when I was 16 or something. You know, and all that stuff. And my wife quit, and we both quit. And I had time. She went to AA before me. But I ended up with more time than her. So when we, in the morning, when it came time for coffee, she had to bring me my coffee because I had more time. That's just the way it works in the group I went to. And so, because she went to AA first, but this guy one time, he says, you know, Hank, I hate to hurt your feelings, but your wife is happy in AA, and she really has taken to this program, and you just don't seem to want to get it or something, you know. And I said, so no wonder she had, no wonder she was happy and everything. Hell, she was high on pills. She just wasn't drinking, that's all. And so I quit drinking on December the 29th, 1969, and she took her last drink and put her, threw her pills down the toilet and flushed them down and quit altogether on January the 1st, 1970. A whole year difference. And I had seniority on her. Anyway, we did fine, and things got better, and we were able to buy a house, a condo in the San Fernando Valley, and then we had an opportunity to buy a house up on the desert, Antelope Valley, and we moved into that place, and I was able to transfer my job and everything. And we were doing well. And then she came to my office and said, I'd just been to the doctor, and the doctor told me I've got cancer, lung cancer. And I said, just, and he said, I've got 3 months to live. And, oh, man. You know, what's the use? You know, trying to do anything, you know. I had long since paid off all those bills I owed, and we had about 10 years or 11 years of sobriety, and now she's going to be sick. And, you know, I didn't take that news very well. I took it selfishly. It's going to be, it's, you know, I'm going to have to take care of her and all that. And so, but it was, I went to my meeting that night because you always go to meetings on your meeting night. Regardless, if you feel bad or you feel good, you still go to your meeting. And that's the way I was trained, that's what I did. And I drew, as I was driving over there to that meeting, I got to thinking about, you know, you haven't done these steps right. You know, you haven't done anything right. You're just, you know, you're just a fringer. You're just hang out in AA, and you're not a good AA member. And I kind of beat myself up, you know. If you had done all the things they'd asked you to do, you wouldn't be taking this news the way you're taking it. And so anyway, I went to a meeting. It was just an average, everyday meeting. It was okay. But at the end of the meeting, they read, it states in, I read on page 164 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it states in there, ask in your morning meditation what you can do for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. And you know, that hit me. That really had a big impact on me. Then it goes on and on, you know. But I heard that, and it had a big impact on me. I've heard it read, they close a lot of meetings in Southern California that way. And I said, yeah, my house, our house is in order. Everything I needed to say to her had already been said, you know. Our bills were paid. We were current in all our affairs. And she lasted 5 years. And she died in January of 1986. And so I retired that year, too, on my birthday. I haven't done a thing. I haven't worked a lick since November of 1986. And they send me money every month. And I got Social Security, and I got insurance coverage, and I got, you know, I couldn't have planned it any better, you know. And as far as money is concerned, it's great. And but you know, she died January of 86, and she didn't even know me at the end. And for the last couple of months, so it was really a blessing that she died. And I think Nancy went to her memorial service. And so now what am I going to do? You know, she's gone. I'm glad I'm not guilty. I'm glad I stayed there. I'm glad I hung in there and took care of her. But what am I going to do now? And I know a lot of people in AA. You know. They'll probably call me up and say, Hank, why don't you come over for dinner? You know, poor old Hank and his wife died. And we'll treat him nice for a while. You know, I can milk that for quite a while. Or I can just stop all this and I can choose to live. She died, not me. And so I started doing the things I was taught, only I doubled up on them. I don't know how many months went by, several months went by, and I started looking at the ladies again. And I get home, and why don't you call that gal? She gave you her phone number. And you know, well, why call her? You know, well, you can call her, maybe she'll go out with you, you know. Well, she won't go out with me. Why? You know, I'm having this argument with myself. Just call her. I call, dial and call her. Would you like to go out Saturday night? Sure. Oh, man. What am I going to do now? I don't know anything about relationships. I've been married all my life. But you know, all those feelings that I had when I was 17, 18, 19 years old, they all came back to me. You know, feeling of inadequacy, clumsiness, and all this stuff relating to a female. I said to myself, you know, I remembered why I drank in the first place. You know, that was it. Women, you know. And I couldn't talk to them unless I had a stomach full of booze. And so, anyway, I said to myself, I'm not going to do that this time. I'm staying sober. You know? And I did. And this substitution thing with me, I've substituted for a lot of great speakers. I substituted for Chuck Chamberlain in a snowstorm blizzard in Omaha, Nebraska. And they got me to the place. And they were expecting 1,000, 1,500 people. 600 people came, and they came to hear Chuck C. And they drove in a blizzard and everything to hear Chuck C. Chuck couldn't make it. He's not feeling well. And we have a substitute, Hank J. from Marina Del Rey. And I, Hank who? You know. And I substituted again for him. And I went to Madison, Wisconsin, and spoke at a breakfast meeting there. And they were expecting Chuck C. The same thing, you know. Chuck is ill, so we've got Hank J. here to talk. You know. Same as today. You know, Wayne was supposed to speak. Here I am. I'm a great substituter, last minute substitute. So, after I got through talking, you know, people thank you, and this woman thanked me. Introduced herself. My name's Linda. I'm an alcoholic. Very glad to meet you. And then several months went by, and I got a call to come and speak on my own, not as a substitute, to come and speak in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I did, and I re-met Linda. She had moved to North Carolina. Her husband's job took him down there. And so she had divorced him. Excuse me. She had divorced him, and so she had submitted my tape to the committee. So I said, you know, if I'm ever back anywhere as near here, maybe I could call you and we'll go out to dinner. And she said, that'll be fine. And I was pretty close one time. I was about 1,200 miles away. So I called her and we went out to dinner. Eventually, we got together and we got married about 8 years ago. She's a good AA. Nancy knows her. And she put her stamp of approval on her, so she's okay. And we started down the road to happy destiny. I had no idea. I wasn't interested in a permanent relationship, you know. I just wanted to take her out, you know. Same with her. I didn't need anybody to fix me. I've already been fixed. AA fixed me. I'm okay with being by myself. I don't need anyone to make me whole. And she felt the same way. And so we got together. We bought a little house and we live in Charlotte, North Carolina, and we started our own meeting, and we call it a Southern Pacific Group. And we have the same format as the Pacific Group in Los Angeles, only with like 125 people instead of 1,500 or whatever. We just had a 10-year celebration, and it's a good meeting. You know, in the South, they don't clap in the South. I don't know why that is. The only time they clap is when they introduce the speaker. And, you know, we started a clapping meeting. You know, we clap for everything. You know, Joe's going to read the traditions. Oh, great, clap, you know, and clap for everything. And then we have birthday parties, you know. People, instead of taking a chip, we have a cake and we put a candle on it and light it for each year you're sober, and there's a candle for each year. We sing happy birthday. And I overheard some young woman was talking about our group. And she says, it's pleasant and it's fun to go there, you know. It's really good, you know. And then they don't give chips for birthdays. They have a cake. It's kind of fun, but it isn't AA. And that's what they think of our meeting in Charlotte. It's okay, but it's not AA. So, anyway, my son, that looked at me so funny back in those days, turns out the reason he looked at me so funny is he was stoned out of his gourd. Seems like he has a problem with booze and drugs, too. And, you know, I hate to say this about him. He used to use my car every once in a while on Friday night when he was a teenager. And I'd get in that car on Saturday morning, and the steering wheel was all sticky. I couldn't, you know, I'd have to wipe it down and everything, you know. And I found out that Matt was sniffing glue. I'm ashamed to have to tell you that, but he was a glue sniffer. But after he had about 5 years of sobriety, he was asked to speak in Palm Springs at this Palm Springs Roundup, and he got big deal, and a couple of thousand people and everything, and he was going to be the young people's speaker, and he bought a suit and new shirt. Got his hair styled, shaved, and his shoes were shiny. He stood up there on the stage, and about 1,200 people standing out there. And he said, my name's Matt Johnson, and I'm the son of a drunken mother and a drunken father. And my wife and I looked at each other and we just burst into tears. We were so goddamn proud. I don't know what's happened to him. I don't know where he got it from, but he's a very successful businessman. And he lives in Santa Barbara, California, on a cliff overlooking the ocean. And his company just gave him a new Mercedes-Benz SUV to drive back and forth to work in. And he's a vice president in charge of sales. Jesus, you know, that's just not him, you know. When he graduated high school, he had a fourth grade level in reading. I thought I was going to have to support that kid for the rest of his life. But he's got 28 years of sobriety. And he sponsors a lot of people in Santa Barbara. And he's a good man. And I'm very proud of him. You know. My daughter turned out okay, too. You know. She lives in Boulder City, Nevada. And last Sunday, this time, they were throwing a party. My son was throwing a party for me because I turned 80 years old. And people from out of the past came to that party, you know. Not everybody, but a lot of people. And it was overwhelming. And my daughter, Candy, drove clear from Nevada. And they just made a big fuss out over me. I don't know how I got here. You know, I don't know. I'm not a book study nut. I'm not, you know, I just try to do what says in the book. And somebody volunteered to do something this morning. I thought, oh, that's a mistake. You never volunteer. Chuck C. said, I never volunteered for anything. But he never turned down an AA request. And that's the way I live. And if it's inconvenient, it doesn't matter. You just do it anyhow. And I love AA. And I love the life I'm living. I'm a little gimpy in the right leg, but outside of that, I'm in good shape. And I know this is a spiritual program. I know that. And I know that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And, you know, it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back. And thank you very much for having me.